From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. This week on Soundings, the second in a series of discussions about the historical origins of social unrest in the 20th century. The topic at hand is Lebanon and political violence in the Middle East. My guests are Jeremy Levin and Herbert Bodman. Jeremy Levin served as bureau chief of the cable news network in Beirut, where he was kidnapped and held as a hostage for 11 months. He escaped in the Bekaa Valley in February 1985. Herbert Bodman is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Jerry Levin and Herbert Bodman, present-day Lebanon is an emblem of captivity, a country in which Christianity shares an uneasy balance with a growing Muslim population. A central issue is the direction that Lebanese culture will take, becoming Europeanized, or by contrast, becoming part of the Muslim world. The growth of Shia fundamentalism and the equally important backdrop of the Israeli-Arab conflict add to the complexity of Lebanon's political and cultural options. Jerry Levin from CNN and Herb Bodman from the University of North Carolina. Again, our topic is the Middle East. Specifically, we're talking about Lebanon. Herb, let's step back just a little bit. How old is social unrest in Lebanon? If, for example, we were to pick up a newspaper at the turn of the century, or if there had been cable news network then and we turned it on, would we see roughly what we're seeing now?
No, I don't think you would, because the people who are restless now had no voice then, had no voice. This is a phenomenon, I think, that you can date really from the 1950s. When I was living in Lebanon in the early 50s, there were undercurrents of this. There was constant stress on the social inequalities, that the upper classes had benefited from the Western connection greatly. But they were leaving the rest of the population behind. One of the interesting things of the 50s was that you very rarely heard anything about Shiites. There were Shiites in the south of Lebanon, but they were dominated by a few families, and they were of very little account.
Let's just pause for a moment and give me a description. When you say the Shiites and you call them fundamentalists, what are you talking about? Are you talking about a faction within a faction? Help me with Jerry. Maybe
well,
you can
well, let's
come
be careful. That every Shiite is not necessarily a fundamentalist.
That's
okay.
Right. Yeah.
But so Shia. Shiism has existed almost from the beginning of Islam, almost from the beginning of Islam.
First generation.
All right. The fundamentalist movement that we keep talking about now, there's been waves throughout history, but the one we're talking about now began with Khomeini in Iran, who single-handedly created it and now wishes to export it. And there are factions within many countries in the Arab world that would like to import it and establish theocracies ruled by the religious leaders. It's as simple as that. But then you can imagine it becomes a very, very explosive force and one that under the right conditions can be exploited.
There are many kinds of fundamentalism.
This is Herb Bodman talking.
Yeah. There are many kinds of fundamentalism in this region. It's not one movement. There are all sorts of ramifications. It's terribly complicated.
If you were to single out one element that is at contention, that's at issue here, it would come down to what? Political control by way of these theological and religious impulses? Is that a fair way to put it?
Recovery of dignity, I would say. Would be a one element.
Recovery of dignity.
And I would add, however, that on a more practical level, maybe the recovery of dignity, but it also is the acquiring of power.
Right.
The fundamental, and you've put your finger on it, part of the problem in terms of we as a nation looking at the Middle East, as we look at it in a very stereotypical fashion and fail to recognize and fail to understand and being failed to be led by our leaders to become aware of the fact that there are factions within factions, that there are threads, that there are several threads instead of, say, one thread. And we have to understand that. So that when so that's why I say it's a matter of trying to acquire power by a group within Arab nations that are have-nots right now. Mm-hmm. In a sense, it is a new type of political / religious movement that would like to supplant secularist governments on the one hand of the left and monarchies on the right, the established form of governments there. And I think that Professor Zonas in Chicago here, who put his finger on the fundamentalist movement, is correct when he says it may be the one unique political development of the 20th century that may grow to have the same kind of impact that communism or Marxism that was born in the 19th century had in the 20th century, Islam may have in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. And what we really have to keep our eyes open is to that, not necessarily to be afraid of it, but to be aware of it.
What about this, Herb Bodman? You look at it from a historical standpoint.
One thing I would qualify here is I don't think it's particularly Islam. It's also Judaism, and it's also Christianity. There is a rolling back of the secular trend which developed in the 18th, early 19th century.
Where did that come from? Was that, again, to be utterly naive, was that a European influence, an American influence?
Yes, I think it was basically that and connected with nationalism, with the emergence of nationalism. You had, in the medieval world, people identified by religion. Now they identify by nation. I don't think it's going to go back to an identification of religion, but at least you're beginning to get a swing in another direction. The secular trend is reversing direction. How far it's going to go, I can't predict.
Again, Herb Bodman from UNC Chapel Hill and Jerry Levin from the Cable News Network. Our topic is Lebanon, social unrest and violence. Why don't we understand them? Why don't they understand us? Jerry?
Well, I think one of the reasons is because we don't want to.
You mean we don't listen, or we deliberately ignore what we hear?
I think we don't want to. We deliberately ignore what we hear. I think an example of that is Secretary Schultz pounding the table with the meeting with the Yugoslav ambassador shortly after Muhammad Abu Abbas was allowed to slip through Yugoslavia, which shouldn't have happened. However, when the Yugoslav ambassador twitted him a little bit and said, "Now you've got to, don't you think that you have to, you know, give some cognizance to what these people are saying?" Secretary Schultz said what has been often said before by people in the administration, in the establishment, said the terrorist acts are heinous enough in themselves. I'm paraphrasing it, and he's right. He's right that they are horrible acts, and we can't condone them. But to close your ears and your eyes to what is behind them, the basic aspirations, the basic anger, the basic grievances, is a big mistake. Now, there's a reason why I say that. Again, terrorism itself is not a new form. We there were a couple of waves of terrorism in the 19th century,
right,
around the 1840s, anarchy, which was a form of terrorism in the 19th century. What you don't hear discussed enough, I feel, is that those acts at that time were clearly a message of grievance, of anger, of anxiety, of deprivation, which the world, to a great extent, ignored to its peril, because they were the cutting edges. They were the cutting edges in both cases of political and sociological revolutions that took place anyway. And they took place because I think they were ignored to the extent they were. The revolutions that took place were perhaps far more cataclysmic than they might have been had the world found a way to come to grips with those earlier and found a way to not just reject out of hand everything that they stood for, but to accommodate some of the direst, the most mm-hmm. critical needs that they expressed. And I think that's happening here again. The question is, are we going to go the way of the world in the 19th century and after World War I?
It appears that we are. Herb Bodman, what mm-hmm. about this?
Well, that's...
It's a $64,000
yes,
question.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes. You have to have a very clear crystal ball to estimate this sort of thing. But certainly, if Lebanon is a symbol of the future, mm-hmm. where you have a society torn apart, literally, we have talked about. The European kidnapped in Lebanon, but there were also a great many Lebanese hostages. They're being taken every day as blood feud resolutions, essentially, or efforts to resolve blood feuds. Mm-hmm. They take each other. And if this is a pattern for the future, God help us all.
I remember, again, last night before our taping session, Jerry Levin from Cable News Network and Herb Bodman from the University of North Carolina. Jerry made the point that the United States government falls down in simply not exerting sufficient pressure to get people talking. Now, that sounds pretty obvious, but it also sounds... Defend that for me, Jerry. What do you mean? What would you have the government do?
Well, our government seems to have a... This particular government, this particular administration, seems to have a consistent policy of not talking with people it doesn't like, or people you might characterize as your enemies. It won't talk to the Sandinistas. Uh-huh. It won't and has not talked directly with the captors holding the forgotten hostages in Lebanon. It turned down an opportunity to have a dialogue with Gaddafi shortly after the first of the year when it's clear that he tendered such an opportunity. I think history has proven countless times that those who do not talk to their enemies are really spoiling for a fight. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want to. They're really spoiling our fight, and they usually get it. And there's one other point that I want to add to that is that when you don't talk, that means that you've already made up your mind that you don't want any understanding. Mm-hmm. You don't want the connection that dialogue can give.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the second program in a series of discussions about the historical origins of social unrest in the 20th century. The topic at hand is Lebanon and political violence in the Middle East. The Soundings panelists are Jeremy Levin and Herbert Bodman. Jerry Levin served as bureau chief of the Cable News Network in Beirut, where he was kidnapped and held hostage for 11 months. He escaped in the Bekaa Valley in February 1985. Herbert Bodman is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. According to Jerry Levin and Herbert Bodman, there are no cultural or political monoliths in Lebanese and Middle Eastern societies. But American understanding of the Middle East frequently succumbs to stereotypical thinking, underscored by a limited sense of political and cultural history. Both Jerry Levin and Herbert Bodman are quick to condemn political violence. They view terrorism as counterproductive psychological warfare in reaction to long-standing social and economic circumstances. Herb Bodman?
May I ask Jerry something here? How do you interpret this in relationship to the hostages in Iran? Is the present administration's stonewalling on this related directly as a reaction to our experience in Iran, do you think?
Yes, I think to a great extent it was. And it is. And I think that there is a 180 degrees difference between the attitude of this administration and the attitude of the Carter administration. President Carter wanted those people out no matter what, and he was willing to sacrifice his own administration. He didn't want to. He didn't want to lose it, but he was willing to sacrifice it. This president, and I can understand from a political point of view that he did not want to sacrifice it. But it's clear, almost from the beginning, that this administration has decided, did decide, that if push came to shove, these hostages will be sacrificed. The administration will go only so far, and certainly not as far as the Carter administration. The Carter administration negotiated, made concessions, reached an accommodation to get these prisoners back. This administration has refused to, which sets it apart almost from any other nation in the world that has had to deal with this problem before. An example of that is Israel, which is a nation that we, that our administration and many people in the United States admire, and I think appropriately, for its firm stand against the cowardice of terrorism. We admire that, and we admire the forthright actions they take to defend themselves and also to try to prevent it. But it only goes so far. You don't hear discussed here at all the fact that when Israelis are taken hostage, the Israeli government will do any and everything to get its citizens freed, including negotiating with terrorists and making exchanges.
That rarely reaches the headlines.
They rarely do, and it's happened several times over the past 10 or 12 years, the latest being the spring of last year when they exchanged for three Israelis who were being held hostage in southern Lebanon for over 1,000 guerrillas and terrorists.
They all came home in tracksuits.
In tracksuits, and they negotiated with Abu Jabril, who is a terrorist leader. What is shameful within this country, the dialogue as to the basic issue involving the captivity of our hostages has not taken place, and that is, what should the response be? All we have heard essentially all along is what the government's policy is: no concession, no negotiations, no deals.
Well, what would you do, Jerry?
And only the government's justification of it. And you haven't heard it debated. It has not been debated or discussed.
Well, what would you do?
I would say after 2 years that we should try to reach an accommodation to get those citizens back. We've had three or four executed already in reprisal for our raid on Libya.
Right.
My question is, I don't believe that the sacrifice of those men has achieved a thing. The government has said all along, if we would foster the idea of some accommodation, some sort of an exchange which would get our people back, that would encourage acts of terrorism. They've apparently done a lot of thinking about that, but they didn't do any thinking at all, apparently, as to would the raid on Libya bring about reprisals that would end up in the deaths of Americans and others overseas, which it did. There were almost as many Americans and Westerners killed in reprisal to the raid on Libya as there were Libyans killed in the raids.
And we were discussing earlier about refusing essentially to recognize realities. Here in that Libyan raid, you have a perfect example of this. There has been no recognition in the government and very little recognition in the press and amongst the public that what lies behind Libyan terrorism is Libya's attitude on the Arab-Israeli conflict. That this is the cancer in that whole region. It's not the only cancer, but it is a large portion of it, and it's right up there on the surface. You hear it constantly. Jerry was talking last night about how when he went to Lebanon, that was the first and almost the last and only thing he heard there in his stay there, the Arab-Israeli conflict.
That's certainly one of the prime irritants in that part of the world. There's no easy solutions to it, but it certainly seems clear in this particular time in which we're living now, that which has taken place after the ending of the latest entente between Arafat and King Hussein, that instead of trying to create a dialogue and pick up the pieces to try to get people talking together, that we acquiesce to a new period of confrontation.
You see, the Muslims on the other side take the Muslim perspective and you have a marshaling of ranks behind Libya, not because they approve of Libya, but because the Western world is attacking Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
You had, at the time that we had the raid on Libya, the foreign ministers of 45 Muslim countries were meeting in Morocco. They passed a resolution unanimously condemning the operation, although we know that amongst them there were many who disapprove of Libya wholeheartedly. Libya is not popular in the Muslim world until it is attacked from the outside.
So you're telling me that history is thicker than blood in a fashion in the Middle East?
Well, the Middle East has had a way, even if it's taken a few decades or even 100 years, of expelling Western irritants, starting with the Crusades.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to happen again.
I agree. I think it's very definitely going to happen again. Russia's influence in the Middle East has declined, although you can't tell that really from United States government statements, because they have to have an opponent there that all of us recognize. But Russia's position, the Soviet Union's position in the Middle East, has declined substantially over my years of involvement in the region. The United States' position has likewise declined. But this leaves essentially a turmoil because there is no consensus in the region itself.
Mm-hmm.
And there is still that irritant, that constant irritant of Israel.
Herb Bodman from the University of North Carolina and Jerry Levin from Cable News Network. Let's look at it from this problem of social unrest, violence, and terrorism in the Middle East from a really long perspective. Herb, what good is history?
Well, I'm not sure you learn lessons from history, at least not specific lessons. But essentially what you do is you get a perspective from history.
Mm-hmm.
History doesn't repeat itself, but the environment, you might say, the atmospherics are there.
Nor does it teach us things necessarily.
No. We have to learn. We have to make mistakes all over again.
Yeah.
But maybe we can make more sophisticated mistakes. But as I see it, the Muslim world was one of the dominant areas in the world in the 15th century. I have a delightful time asking my students, if you were plunked down in the 15th century, what would be the great powers of the world? What would be the Russia and United States and China of that period? And inevitably, they speak of Europe, Habsburgs, Britain, and so forth, these minor powers of that time.
So they're committing the same mistakes after a fashion that we commit today.
Sure. The perspective is all off.
Uh-huh.
They don't talk about the Ming. They don't talk about the Mughals. They don't talk about the Ottomans. These were the great powers of that period. And then you have, by the 18th century, a substantial shift in power to Europe and the United and the Western Hemisphere. That always creates trauma when you have a shift like that. Look what Britain and France did in 1956 in the Middle East and the Suez Crisis as part of their reaction to decolonization, to a loss of power in the post-World War world. They went in and tried to restore things by gunboat diplomacy. Are we in the same situation now ourselves?
It would appear so. Jerry Levin?
Yes, I would think so. And we have, at least in especially the last year or so, we have resorted more and more towards that, or the threats of it, and less to, I think, appropriate diplomacy. And I think the fact that we don't talk to people that we don't like, We don't try to establish contacts with them. I think is very dangerous and works against us.
Is it possible that things like that are going on that that the administration simply doesn't want us to know about? Are we being too cynical in our description here of the efforts or the failure of the effort to patch things up and tease the threads out?
Well, I think that it's possible that we might, but every time we get to thinking like that, the administration itself makes sounds and statements that would indicate otherwise.
The results simply don't provide us any substance.
I see the difference here in that the technical level of our government in foreign affairs, I think, understands these issues quite well.
But they don't reach the politics.
It's the politics that get in the way.
Yeah.
The politicians in policy-making positions deny their technical specialists.
Yeah, there's no political expression of this technical expertise.
We have now the power, essentially, to create a stalemate with the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
We've built up that power. What we're talking about here is a very different kind of situation vis-a-vis the Third World, which is in itself a very diverse world and probably doesn't exist. But for the purposes,
except as a convenient label for the journalists.
Yeah, for now, let's use that that label. In the Third World, we are facing a situation where naked power, atomic weapons, and so forth aren't effective.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the kind of conflict. Resolution that we're looking for there. We have to treat that world very differently from the way that we treat the Soviet Union, and we're not doing it.
Mm-hmm. Jerry Levin.
As a matter of fact, in recent years, we have used the methods that we have ostensibly built up to keep the Soviet Union at arm's length on the Third World, and we're being more diplomatic and doing more talking, in a sense, with the Soviet Union than we are with the Third World. The tools have been reversed.
And the tools that we have in the Soviet vis-a-vis the Soviet Union just don't work in the Third World.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the historical origins of social and political unrest in Lebanon and the Middle East. My guests were Jerry Levin of the Cable News Network and Herbert Bodman of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. While serving as CNN bureau chief in Beirut, Jerry Levin was kidnapped and held hostage for 11 months, escaping in February 1985. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Social Unrest in Lebanon and the Middle East, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation with CNN's Jerry Levin and his wife, Sis Levin, whose efforts were central to her husband's release from political captivity in 1985. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about the historical origins of social unrest in Lebanon and the Middle East. Some answers and insights from Jerry Levin, former hostage and Beirut bureau chief of the Cable News Network, and from Herbert Bodman of the University of North Carolina. Lebanon, Emblem of Captivity. This week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.